Was there, did you have something in mind? I mean, was that you just saying, well, this is Paul Simon, I'm here, and I'm still crazy after all these years?
Well, I think, you know, just quite obviously, that's how I felt at that point. That wasn't a good time in my life emotionally. It's the end of my marriage, and I don't know, just... I think I wrote that song like in a hotel. Like I think I was living in a hotel at the time. And it's funny, you know. Sometimes when I do it in a concert, I don't sing that song too often. But if I do it, it takes on another quality. It doesn't have a particularly sad quality to it now. Well, I guess all these songs, when you think of them in the past, you know, if people really know a song. It loses its whatever it first had and takes on a nostalgic quality. So, and I don't even think of it as a particularly sad. But at the time, it was a dark period.
Paul Simon, our co-host on The World of Rock, is you have been in the past a person that didn't really want to talk about something that is very obvious to everyone now in our world of rock. You as a writer never really liked to accept any sort of praise for the term a poet, you know, which you are in my ears and people, because it the blending and how you approach your songs and what you do with your musicians is one thing, but what you say is a whole different thing. And see, in our world of rock, there are people who make a sound, and it's a sound that people like. I mean, in their music, there is a sound. But also, some people have a message with that, too. Some people just have a sound. Some people have both. And in your case, you have both. But, I mean, all the way back to the very beginning and up now to this new album, Paul Simon is a poet, so I just want you to make sure you're accepting that.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Can we proceed on that basis?
You know how I think about this? I think that really good songwriting... is all about sound, and the words have to have a very appealing sound to them. Beyond that, if the sounds that are, you know, really pleasing to your ear have a meaning, well, then that's even better writing. But if it's just a meaning without the really good sound, then it's not as good a song as a song that has a good sound and no meaning. Because one of the great influences on my music, I don't know if you'll be surprised to hear this, but is and I think of all the big writers out of my generation, is Chuck Berry, because Chuck Berry was just a genius at sound. The words came and it just. They had a flow to it, like a conversational flow, but also they were rhythmically right, and the sound of the vowels was all right, and the story was just interesting as hell. So, I mean, my subject matter is entirely different from Chuck Berry's, but I try and make the totality of it, the sound of the words and the meaning of the words to be... An integrated unit, and when it really works, then I think it's a really good song.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. I'll stand corrected on that, because I think when I say something about the poetry part, that's true. But if we go to something real, a simple photograph for the memory and all that, the sound that was there made that photograph appear. Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, something as real, basic, quiet, and beautiful as that was.
I think that our oral recollection, our hearing, is one of the most powerful of our senses connected to emotion. I mean, I think people can be made to feel emotion more powerfully by hearing an old song that's familiar to them and connected to something of importance, even more than if they see an old film, you know, old footage, or even an old photograph. Similar, but somehow to me, I think the sound is even more powerful in emotional force.
it's always a compliment to an artist and a writer and a performer to have someone do some of their work. Hazy Shade was something you just kind of think that really belongs to you, but it doesn't when you hear it. And somehow or other, I always thought there's another example of what you were talking about, where there's a whole lot going on there, but the movement of the music is rapid, as if there was wind involved, even, you know, like it's usually in winter, and yet there's the quietness part of winter too. But you got it all together with your sound. The music is telling the story too. I see what you mean.
Yeah. That happens to be a really nice cover record. It's it's unusual that a cover record can be as good as the original. I think that may be better than the original. There's only been a handful of cover records that I really liked on my. I mean, there's been a lot of recordings of my songs, but just a few that I really think are sensational, just as good or even better than the way I did it or the way Simon and Garfunkel did it.
Something come to mind besides Hazy?
Well, there's a great Aretha Franklin cover of Bridge Over Troubled Water. In fact, she had a number one record on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nice Elvis Presley cover of Bridge Over Troubled Water, too. There's a beautiful Bill Evans recording of I Do It For Your Love. Paul Desmond did a whole album that was really nice. Not that much more, really.
This is The World of Rock, and our special co-host and guest is Paul Simon. With so many songs and so many things going on, that we have an album here, we can share a lot of memories together, and that's exactly what we're doing. Paul Simon, as co-host, is introducing some of the songs, story here or there, but we're reliving the music and some of the people, those people that you wanted for this particular idea, the musicians that were involved. It's really fascinating because makes your life real interesting. As you've said, you're not a part of a group, so you don't have a regular group.
Right. No, and not so, part of a band.
Right. You don't have people following you around going on tour. Your tour might be, as the last one was with Graceland, a totally different sound and direction to come from, as a lot of these were. So how about Late in the Evening?
Late in the Evening is that same New York rhythm section. Steve Gadd, another great Steve Gadd drum part. I think that the opening riff, boom, 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 I think that's Tony Levin. And Eric Gale made that up. Richard T is on that again. The vocal backgrounds, I try and put vocal backgrounds on a lot of records, and I have different sounds that I try and imitate if I'm the vocal group. In this particular case, I'm the vocal group, so... And I'm trying to imitate the Crickets, the group that played and sang behind Buddy Holly. And the song, of course, is from the movie One Trick Pony and from that album.
Paul Simon's Late in the Evening and some Crickets and Buddy Holly sound. And I guess, Paul, that's amazing how after all the years that their music doesn't really sound dated, does it? I mean, it doesn't have a thing like, wow, that was real tinny or whatever it was, or anything. They made some good records.
Oh, great. He was a great record maker.
You love, I can tell, you know, you love to go back and pick out things that you liked, because when you're growing up and getting into the thing, you had these records, and it wasn't like there was a lot of them. During the late 60s, maybe 50 albums a day would show up. But in the 50s, in the mid-50s, it was, you were lucky if you had 50 good records.
I never bought albums in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't much around.
I never thought of it buying an album. I mean, albums were the hit song or the two hit singles, and then.
No, I think there were more different fillers. Artists too. I mean, the pop, as it was called, in pop music, artists were doing singles, and you might get an album by them of a lot of those, but an album wasn't even on your mind. Everybody had their singles collection, and that's why in England they still make their discs so you can use the old 45 record players, you know.
Right.
And even though it's a current product, they had that large hole in the middle, or the smaller one for the people who still have the old record player where you could play
right. One
or the other. But, yeah, it was a singles existence. You had, you've mentioned now several times some of the people had an influence, but I think really you liked so much music that did you have anybody real that you were thinking about vocally? Did you have a bunch of different people? I mean, you obviously liked everything that came along that hit your ears, so really.
Well, no, I didn't like anything, everything. I mean, I had very strong opinions as a kid. I think kids have very strong opinions about what they like and what they don't like. I like doo-wop. If you grew up in New York, you like doo-wop. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think the great doo-wop group was Frankie Lyman. And for vocalists, I loved Sam Cooke. I thought he was just had a great voice, and it was a fantastic Fraser and Elvis Presley. Those tracks, the sound of the echo on those tracks. Vocal group sounding, I guess it would be probably comes from white gospel. The group that sang behind Presley, what was it called?
Jordanaires,
right? The Buddy Holly, the Crickets. I mean, that's all that southern sound I liked.
Then you also liked, like in New York, then you probably liked the groups who were local here, like Five Satins and Moonglows and all. So when Paul Simon went out to buy a record, he might be buying Elvis, or he might be buying, one of them.
Well, Art Garfunkel and I started to audition for record companies when we were 14. We used to take the train into Manhattan, take the D train, get into Manhattan, then go up to record companies. I mean, in those days, you could they were tiny little record companies in these little buildings scattered around Broadway. You'd go in, you open the door, you'd come in, and you'd say, "We want to audition," and take out your guitar, and they'd listen to you. And, I mean, in fact, we were signed to a record contract by Morty Craft's label when we were 14. We never made the record, but by the time we were 15, we made our first record. And when we were 15 years old, we went on American Bandstand with Hey School Girl when we were called Tom and Jerry. So it's been my profession since I'm 15. That's how long I've been making records.
Early start for Paul Simon at age 15, not as Simon and Garfunkel, but we made that transition because you and Art certainly did. That was some heavy time, wasn't it? You started to move fast and furious, you guys.
Well, we were still in high school. That was very exciting. We were kids, 15 years old, 16 years old, and making a record. I mean, to hear your record on the radio when you're a kid back then, or to go on American Bandstand, made us heroes in our high school, Forest Hills High School.
And heroes everywhere else, too. Well, at that time, just before 15 now, was there somebody, I didn't ask you this, was there somebody at home in your house that encouraged you to go into music, or did it just happen to you alone and you went out and did this stuff? Was your father, your mother, or anybody else around just, kind of encouraging you? Or was it a solo thing?
A lot had to do with my friendship with Art.
Mm-hmm.
We lived right near each other. He was the best singer in the neighborhood. And we became friends and started to sing together. And our first models were Robert and Johnny. They were a duo. And we started to sing like them. And then when the Everly Brothers arrived, we started to imitate the Everly Brothers and learn to get a blend the way the Everly Brothers did. My father was a musician. He was a bass player and a band leader, but, of another, not a rock and roll generation. So, I mean, he didn't have any interest in rock and roll. I mean, he encouraged me to play music, and he bought me my first guitar and all that, but I can't really say that he liked rock and roll, certainly not the early rock and roll.
And I guess what comes around kind of goes around, too, because you mentioned the Everly Brothers. And in Graceland, you went back to your idols and they came and did a little session with you, didn't they?
That's right, but not together. Phil is recorded in Los Angeles and Don in New York.
They're still at that.
Well, no, not really. I mean, it wasn't because there was any bad blood between the brothers at that point. I think they get along pretty well now. I just couldn't coordinate it with them. That was the only way I could coordinate it, so I did it that way.
Our guest on the World of Rock, special guest and wonderful co-host, is Paul Simon. And Paul, we've kind of covered that early part of Paul Simon and meeting Art Garfunkel and so forth. And then there was this huge thing happening, and you were right there. And it is best expressed, I guess, as the folk scene. Here we are in the 60s, and folk is happening, and messages are being written, and songs are being made and recorded, and you were right into that, for sure.
The scene was Bleecker and McDougal. That's what it was. The clubs that were down on Bleecker and around Bleecker Street and McDougal. And I was around for a little while there, going to hootenanny nights on Tuesday nights at the Gaslight or Folk City or something like that. But then I moved to England, and there was a folk scene happening there too, and that's where that's my second major musical influence, because that's where I learned acoustic. I switched from playing electric guitar in the early rock and roll days, rhythm electric guitar, to playing acoustic guitar and learning finger picking styles, a lot of the early Simon and Garfunkel records were songs that I wrote when I was in England. Not The Sound of Silence, that was written here, but I Am a Rock, Homeward Bound, Scarborough Fair is an old English folk song that I learned from a great guitarist over there named Martin Carthy. There was several acoustic blues players who influenced my style: Davy Graham, Bert Jance, John Renbourn. And that kind of slapping the strings, acoustic, I mean, you can hear it particularly in Mrs. Robinson, that, that slapping style. I learned that when I was living in England, and Simon and Garfunkel became a hit in the United States while I was still living in England, and then I came back here at 1966. I was living in England 64, 65. And came back. The folk scene, one of the other great contributions of the folk scene, I think, is that it was really interested in different cultures. I mean, Bob Dylan was interested in Woody Guthrie, and that took people into American country, whatever you want to call it, political writing of the 30s and 40s, Lead Belly, music from other cultures, Spanish music. I think that also, made it easier for me to expand my interest in music from other cultures. So when I first heard El Condor Pasa, for example, in Paris, I was playing a show in Paris and heard Los Incas play El Condor Pasa. It just sounded like a great melody. I didn't think, well, this is a very foreign piece of music. It just sounded like a beautiful song. And the folk scene was open enough so that it was willing to accept almost anything except amplified guitar. And then when Dylan united folk and rock with the amplified guitar, well, then everything fell together again.
This particular day, we're talking to Paul Simon, who is our co-host on World of Rock, and we're doing a chance for Paul to be our co-host and talk about Negotiations and Love Songs, which is new album, giving us all the wonderful music in one collection from Paul, Slip Sliding Away. Sounds like, well, something that could have been definitely influenced by more or less the rock roots by just slipping and sliding.
I'm sure, yeah, that's right, the phrase. Yeah, Little Richard song.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, in every album, there's some phrase. I mean, and you can call me Al. I think there's a line like, he ducked back in the alley, you know, which comes right out of, what's the Little Richard song?
Long Tall Sally. Well,
right, yeah. There's always something that I put in. Slip Sliding Away's got the Oak Ridge Boys. Really good country vocal. I shouldn't call. Yeah, I'll call it country.
Yeah, country. Oh yeah.
They were gospel at that point, but they've crossed over now to be a major country act.
Slip Sliding Away. Okay, that's I always like that too. But you know, I think you can tell when you're in a studio and you're making a record, and regardless of the people, you've always gone somewhere or brought people around to have that fun in the studio, and it translates to people because then they go out and you got another hit record, you know. In this album, it's a chance for everybody to relive the songs, and Hearts and Bones is an interesting thing. Want to cover that for us?
Hearts and Bones, this was a very autobiographical. The Hearts and Bones album is overtly autobiographical. Album, and was my least successful album commercially speaking, I think the reason is, as I said to you earlier, I'm always looking for the right rhythm section, and on this album I never really got it. You know, I mean, I take different players and try to put them together, but I never found that unit that gelled and could produce a groove. And I think the best songs on Hearts and Bones, I think some of the songs were really good writing, but I don't think I made my best records on those songs, in a rhythm sense anyway. And because of that, they weren't heard and they weren't hits. And when I came to work on Graceland, I said, "Now, I'm not going to make this mistake again. I mean, I'm going to make good rhythm songs here, but I don't want to compromise my writing. I want to write at the level that I wrote on Hearts and Bones, which to me was a breakthrough in writing. I thought my lyric writing." Got better on Hearts and Bones. Took a step up from my other work, and in Graceland, I tried to stay at that level, but put it on top of a rhythm track that really cooked. But I'm very proud of some of the songs on Hearts and Bones, and I think they'll probably be the least familiar songs on this retrospective album.
You're listening to The World of Rock, and our co-host is Paul Simon. We are negotiating with Negotiations and Love Songs, and it's a great compilation album, and getting some of the history and some of the roots, and, of course, the career of Paul Simon. The Train in the Distance, which we went to there after Hearts and Bones. Phyllis, bring us up to date, because we're coming to a real good song here, and I want to, you know, go back to a reference we made to Alan Freed in early rock and roll, which will be in our next song.
Train in the Distance came about. It's literal. I was sitting talking to some friends of mine, and they had a house that was near a railroad, and the train. And I heard the train, and I said, "Oh, yeah, that's a great sound." Well, everybody loves the sound of a train in the distance.
It's true.
And as soon as I said that, I thought, "Well, yeah, that's nice. I have to keep that in mind for a song." So, I mean, it was literally. I did think everybody does like that sound, and then metaphorically, it's sort of the grass is always greener. It always seems like there's a better place to go to, and the thought that life could be better. Is, I mean, the lyric is, the thought that life could be better is woven indelibly into our hearts and our brains.
You mentioned the trains, though, but that is true, because all through the past, before you started recording and everything, there was songs about trains. And,
a very romantic
image.
You know,
not just, you know, something that everybody knows. Train arrived 16 coaches long, and some Elvis and some early country stuff and all that, Johnny Cash, and all the guys were always talking about trains and the Orange sure. Blossom special, and it's a fascination. It's good. As a matter of fact, we mentioned Johnny Cash and some of the other things that Alan Freed used to do, because Alan Freed was our pioneer in rock radio in all of its forms, because Alan was into rhythm and blues and into basic stuff. Doesn't make any difference what was happening. His ear was always into that. And you kind of got involved in that with Renee and Georgette, sort of.
Rene Magritte was a great surrealist painter, and I was looking through a book of his, you know, of his paintings, and there was a photograph of Rene Magritte, who was Belgian, and his wife Georgette, and the photograph, the caption under the photograph said, "Rene and Georgette." No, it said Georgette and Rene Magritte with their dog during the war. But I remembered it as Renee and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war. And I thought, oh, that's a very interesting title for a song. I don't know what the song is going to be about, but it's an interesting title. And I wrote a surrealistic song. So I had the Magrittes coming to New York, and I integrated them into the world of the early groups. The Penguins, the Moonglows, the Orioles, and the Five Satins. There's something about the names of those groups that also seems, in a way, mysterious and surreal. You can't tell whether, if you're not familiar with the groups, you don't know whether you're talking about some strange image in a painting, the Penguins, the Moonglows, the Orioles, the Five Satins. But if you do know it, you know I'm talking about those days, the Alan Freed days, when those groups had the big hits, and the group that's singing in the background is "Will You Take Part in My Life, My Love." That group. That is my dream. Life is but a dream by the Harptones.
Harptones.
That's who the group is singing in the background. The Harptones.
Paul Simon, you moved right from Rene and Georgette Magritte to Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, and that was an interesting segue, as we call it. Now, explain that for us. That was really good, because it does have it brings us to now, almost, you know? It's like
In putting the album together, I mean, I picked the songs that I liked the best. I didn't necessarily pick hits. I just picked what I thought was the best representation of my work. But also I thought about the transitions, and it seemed to me that jumping from the Magritte song into South African vocal music would have pleased Magritte, because it's a kind of surreal leap in and of itself. And of course it goes to my favorite singing group, Ladysmith Black Mambazo. The song was the last song that we cut on the Graceland album, and it's probably when I was at the point where I was most at ease with the music and able to combine elements, because Black Mambazo hadn't sung with a band before. They're an a cappella group. It also has the addition of West African drummers, Youssou N'Dour, who's out on the Amnesty tour now. His band plays with Peter Gabriel.
Yes.
You know who he is?
Mm-hmm.
Right. That percussion section is overdubbed on top of the South African rhythm section, and that's an interesting sound too.
Well, I think we've mentioned Graceland now in the album. I think if we take, and we're talking to people all over America here and in different sections, we find that in the course of time, the time that it took for people to recognize and get a hold of Graceland was really lengthy for an album. I mean, it lasted a long time, so it's deserving of the many different songs and the different things. It's deserving of all the awards that it got. I believe you were out of the country when the awards were made, but it just hands down. Probably, again, is a perfect example of you again in the quest, search for something that you wanted to do with your material to get a sound, rhythm, and, you know. It took a while, I guess, to put Graceland together, didn't it? But you're saying that that's sort of an extension of what you'd been writing about that you wanted to have so that people would be able to hear it better. So you did the...
Yeah, I think the whole course of my writing is a natural extension. I don't feel that there was ever any strange leap to some new place. Every record implied the next record. Hearts and Bones, the lyric writing in Hearts and Bones, which was really interesting to me. I took from that and I said I must write on a level that still stays interesting to me, but I think I'll have to be more accessible than a song called Renee and Georgette Magritte with Their Dog After the War, which, I mean, you know, being realistic, most people have never heard of Renee Magritte. And those that have heard of him probably never heard of the Penguins and the Moonglows and the Orioles and and vice versa. So I said... if I want to write songs that people are going to hear, I'm going to have to be a little bit more accessible. And even though many people felt that it was a really strange and unusual move to go to African music, I didn't hear the music as that strange. To me, it sounded like a lot like 50s rock and roll. The same grooves, the same chord structures, three chord music. And I approached it in sound similarly to the way I would have approached the music a long time ago. But I tried to keep the level of lyric writing on a sophisticated yet understandable level as I could.
So that, Graceland with its many songs, because as I said, the album lasted, and there's so many things in there that I found that Graceland itself or... Well, the first thing I believe anybody heard was "You Can Call Me Al."
Yes, that was the first.
As an advance from the album,
right?
And that's interesting. "You Can Call Me Al." It sounds, we're going back to what we were talking about: street expressions,
right,
and things that everybody relates to, and all. And yet, that's not really it at all. The boy in the bubble, that's got its story there too, but you know, you get it out by these incredible sounds. And
"You Can Call Me Out" was helped a lot by the video with Chevy Chase. I think it just added another dimension that there was some comedy happening. It made it easier for people, and it turned out that the music was accessible, and South African music has reached a much wider audience now. Johnny Clegg is having some success with Savuka now. In France, he's an enormous star. He's been touring here and doing very well. Ladysmith Black Mambazo tours. Their solo album, their first album, sold about 300,000 copies, which is quite amazing for a group that's singing in Zulu. And they just released their second album. So the music became very popular, as it deserved to be, and I think from that other African music is easier for people to approach other African music and not think of it as some history lesson or a National Geographic exploration. You know, it's just great music. Happens to come from another culture, but our own country has so many cultures in it that have interesting music as well. I mean, we should open our ears to it, because it's just going to benefit. We're going to feel the benefit of it if we get to hear the richness that's right here in our own country.
Paul Simon, I do want to thank you so very much for being our co-host in the World of Rock and sharing your music and your voice and your stories with the people around America who join us here, because you are an integral and important part of our music. So that's why we've enjoyed having you as a co-host, and I hope you'll come back.
Of course. Thanks very much.